Hey, everybody. I want to welcome you once again to Grace Life Bible Church here on YouTube. We appreciate you tuning in as always. I have a guest with me here once again, and my guest is, again, Alex Boyko. Those of you that watched the channel last week, you'll remember that I did a video with Alex where we talked about a research breakthrough on identifying the editor of the 1683 Cambridge Quarto Edition. Alex did some excellent research, and he presented a document, and we went through that information. So, Alex, welcome to the channel.
Thank you. Thank you for having me once again.
Yeah. So we have up here, this is on the screen is the video from last week, Research Breakthrough, Uncovering the Identity of the 1683 Cambridge Editor, Chat with Alex Boyko. And so, Alex, we want to continue this conversation, and I want to bring up the document that we had from last week. And I want to just draw people's attention to a section of your document that I felt we kind of went over real quick, and that sort of setting up then what we want to talk about in today's video. And that's this section right here, Anthony Scattergood's editorial work on the text. And what Alex did was he compared a ton of different editions in this table right here, okay? And we're going to zero in this video on just this example right here on Deuteronomy 23:25 related to the word neighbor or neighbors. And Alex, correct me if I'm wrong, but you checked London, Oxford, Edinburgh, Amsterdam, Cambridge, all these editions you checked in preparing this table. Is that correct?
That I did, yes.
So, Alex, can you just briefly explain what this section of the table represents when you have no change over here, these columns are blank, and then you have two entries here for Cambridge? Can you just reiterate to everybody like what the information on the table means here?
Yes, so you see to your left the verse there, the change from neighbors plural to neighbors singular. If there is a blank where there is the London, Oxford, Edinburgh, and Amsterdam, that means that the presses where the Bible was printed, they don't have that change at all. So it's still neighbors. There's no change there. So it's in the no change column. If there is an addition in a column, then that means that there was a change made to the verse. That's essentially what it means there.
So the bulk of these then are, I'm assuming, from these four presses, and they have no change. They read neighbors, not neighbor, in Deuteronomy 23:25, correct?
Yeah, and also Cambridge as well. They're in there as well. It's a mix of London, Oxford, Edinburgh, Amsterdam, and Cambridge printings in that no change.
So what you're saying then is there are Cambridge editions also that have no change, which means that the Cambridge University Press itself was unevenly printing this verse in their editions.
Yes.
All right. Well, Alex, that was a great explanation there, because I think that we kind of went over that pretty quick last time as we kind of got pressed for time at the end. So, Alex, I'm going to go ahead and unshare my screen, and I want you to take us through like a zoom. You're going to zoom in here on the example of Deuteronomy 23:25 in your document. So go ahead and share your document, and then we can walk through what this looks like.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Okay. Can we see the document?
We can now. Can you zoom in a little bit on that? Make it as big as you can so we can see it nice and clear.
Are we good?
That's good right there, yep.
Okay. So last Thursday, as Brian mentioned, we discussed Anthony Scattergood. We discussed his editorial work on the text with the 1677 and the 1683 Cambridge Quarto. And we showed that there was more than enough evidence to prove that Anthony Scattergood, he not only edited the cross-references for the 1677 and the 1683 Cambridge Quartos, but he also edited the text itself. And what we're going to do, again, as Brian mentioned, is with the table that was shown just a couple minutes ago, we are going to be looking at one particular verse, and that's going to be Deuteronomy 23:25. And we're going to be showing that in the case of going from neighbors plural to neighbor singular, we're going to prove that that is an example of an editorial change. And so what we're going to do is we're going to be looking at a wide variety of editions. We're going to be starting with 1611, and then we're going to be ending with Blaney's text of 1769. So we're going to start here with the 1611. This is a 1611 London Folio black letter. This is H309. And when we look at the verse right here, we see, when thou comest into the standing corn of thy neighbors, then thou mayest pluck the ears with thine hand, but thou shalt not move a sickle unto thy neighbor's standing corn. So we're mainly going to be focusing on this neighbor, on this neighbors right here. We see that it is plural and it is not singular. Now, for this, I looked at our Dropbox file and I looked to see what we had when it came to additions and what I had pulled. And what I found was that from 1612 to 1619, there are no changes to a rather unique Amsterdam. It really shouldn't be called, it's an addition here, but there's some things that are kind of associated with it that I'm going to get into. It was done by a gentleman by the name of Henry Answorth in 1619. And I'm going to do my two pages.
So let me just clarify there, Alex. What you're saying then, if I'm understanding you right, is from 1612 to 1619, all the editions in London are printing that neighbors with an S on the end, and Ainsworth is going to introduce a different construct to that in 1619, yes. Correct?
Absolutely, yes.
All right.
So we see right here in 1619 with Answorth, we see the verse being done this way. When thou comest into the standing corn of thy neighbor. Okay, so this now becomes a singular. And we see that there's a couple of things going on here. There's a semicolon here where the comma used to be. And then there's another comma here. But you see here that this is singular. Now, there's a lot of things going on with this particular verse here with Answorth, and I want to spend some time talking about why this is, because there's a lot of things going on, and you can see that this is an Amsterdam printing. I want to talk about a little bit some information about Answorth, just because he's not someone that kind of you would think would do some things with the text at this time, but he did. So the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography provides the following information on Henry Answorth. So, quote, many consider Answorth one of the finest Hebrew scholars of his day. His interest in languages may have begun at Cambridge. If so, it was powerfully strengthened when he arrived in Amsterdam, which had a large Jewish population living near the ancient church. By 1605, Answorth had become part of an Amsterdam circle of English Hebraists that included Hugh Broughton, Matthew Slade, and later John Paget. These men sought to further their understanding of the Bible by learning its original languages. Personally, Answorth believed that by studying the Hebrew texts carefully and translating them as literally as possible, the, quote, mysteries of godliness therein implied may the better be discerned. All right, and that's from his annotations upon the Book of Genesis. So, you notice here the term, or maybe it may or may not be in here, but Answorth would be considered a separatist. So he was someone who he opposed the Kirk of England, right? And so as a result of that, he's going to be going to Amsterdam and he'll be joining some other people there. So he would be what we would consider kind of in history a separatist. Okay,
yeah.
So let me move on here to some of the things that he did. So in the preface to the Book of the Psalms, English both in prose and meter with annotations, you know, so on and so forth, that was done in 1612. Answorth is going to provide the reader with information on how he did his translation. Now, this is his own fresh translation of the Psalms. This is not something that's coming from the King James. This is his own fresh translation of the Psalms. Okay? So, quote, the text I set down in such manner, as I neither omit the grace of the Hebrew tongue, wherein the Psalms were first penned, minding how the apostles writing in Greek do choose many Hebraisms as having their weight, neither yet use I such uncouth phrases as the uncommon reader understands not. having therein both rule and example in the New Testament as the learned in tongues do know, and I occasionally manifest in sundry annotations. So we see here that I neither omit the grace of the Hebrew tongue, so he's using the Hebrew here, all right, but he's going to be doing a fresh translation of the Hebrew. That's going to become important later on here. So he then goes on to say that, quote, I differ somewhat in phrase from our former English Bible, not because I affect novelty, but in Christian liberty, which is not tied to words. I use what I judge best without prejudice to other, and this falleth out to be the more, because these songs were not only translated, but many of them printed before I could see our late, well-amended translation. When he talks about former English Bible right there, I'm assuming he will be talking about based on some different things going on at this time. Most likely he's talking about the Geneva Bible. The Vickers Bible is around at this time, but because of some things that Answorth was involved in, most likely he will be talking about the Geneva Bible here. And then also the late well amended, most likely he's talking about the King James here from what I can.
So yeah, just real quick. So he says, but many of them printed before I could see out our late, well-amended translation. So he's saying there that he did this work before he saw the King James. That's why I understand that.
Yep, exactly, yep.
Okay, yep, go ahead.
So now we get into some little bit of some interesting things here. So among the translations which I have compared, I much respect the Greek work of the LXX interpreters. Okay, that's the Septuagint. Which being yep. abroad before the apostles' times, they much followed, even where it varied from the Hebrew in words, but not in meaning. Hereupon it is that I so often follow and mention the Greek, yet bind I not myself always to their version, binding them often to mistake things, some of which the Holy Ghost correcteth. Wisdom, therefore, would not have us to go follow them in all things, but to weigh the force of the original Hebrew. The Chaldee paraphrase being made by ancient Jews near the apostles' time, I sometime allege for the meaning of some places. Some of the annotations are specially for them that have judgment in the Hebrew tongue. The properties whereof they explain, others are for more general use of all, that will take pains to compare the scriptures. So what we see here is in his preface to the Psalms, he's explaining that, notice what's important here, I have compared. Yeah. It's not saying that he's using, because he mentions the Septuagint, he mentions the Chaldee paraphrase. He's not translating them directly. He's comparing them. So in various different places when he's doing his work, he's looking at the Septuagint, he's looking at the Chaldee paraphrase, and he's saying, okay, you know, what exactly is going on here? You know, and he's mainly doing it with his annotations. That's what he's mainly using it for.
He says there too that he weighs it against the force of the original Hebrew.
Exactly. Yep.
So, yeah. Exactly. So build it out for us here, Alex. What does this background? How does this background help us understand why there's a change in the spelling of neighbors?
Absolutely. So if we continue going on here, based on what we see with his work on the Psalms. We go and see in 1622 his annotations on Genesis. He did his whole work on the Pentateuch in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and in Deuteronomy. We see that they are combined into one volume, and his work on the Psalms is also included here. And we see that in his preface to his work on the Pentateuch, we see, and it's called the Annotations from the Five Books of Moses in the Book of the Psalms, we see that the same logic is being repeated here. So next is main help of the scriptures themselves. I compare the Greek and the Chaldee versions, the first of them being in the world before Christ coming in the flesh, the other soon after, both of great authority, especially the Greek, honored even by the apostles, and they're so often following, not only in the words, but even the theological exposition. Wherefore, as occasion is offered, I observe sundry things from the Greek translation, which serve for the better understanding of Moses' text and other scriptures that have reference to the same. All right, so again, just kind of more of these things there. And then concerning the Chaldee paraphrase and other Hebrew doctors of the ancient sort, and some later of best esteem for learning as Mamoni, a rabbi. So again, just going that he's using these things. And I actually have pulled up here his annotation. This is Answorth's annotation. Now, this is not the verse, but how it's organized is he has the verse a couple pages up. He has the whole entire, you know, section of Deuteronomy that, you know, he's translating. And then after the text, when you get to the final chapter of Deuteronomy, then you start to see everything is sectioned off and you have the annotation. So this is what verse 25, this is what it's talking about here. It's talking about some things when it comes to some additional cross references that may help. So then he mentions here the Chaldee. So he's not mentioning the Septuagint, but he's really mentioning some things when it comes to the Chaldee. So he's using this here to see, here also saith, when thou art hired into thy neighbor's standing corn. So he's talking about, you know, how exactly he's going through this here.
Right.
So he's not mentioning in particular here, when I looked at this, he's just, again, you see what he's doing. He's looking at other references. He's being very honest here when it comes to the work that he's doing. So it's not just something that's just, slapped together. It's something that a lot of thought was put into this. So there's nothing here, based on what I can see, that he's mainly looking at the Chaldee paraphrase, you know, for this. He's not looking at the Septuagint mainly. But again, just to show you what he did. So what exactly can we conclude from all of this? Well, we can conclude that Answorth, he produced his own version of the Psalms and the Pentateuch, right, so it's his own translation, shortly after the King James Bible was published. So we also know that he looked at the original Hebrew, that we certainly did, and we saw also that it's very similar to the King James Bible when it comes to the words that were used and when it comes to certain things with the reading. The only change is with the plural or the singular form of the noun. So we see that he was being faithful to the original Hebrew there and using other things to mainly in the annotations to clarify some things. And he had the same view of these external sources, like the Chaldee paraphrase and the LXX, like the King James translators. And like them, he understood that they have problems. This is from the preface, Miles Smith's preface, when it came to the Septuagint. So it said, quote, "Yet for all that, as the Egyptians are said of the prophet to be men and not God, and a horse's flesh and not spirit, so it is evident, and Saint Jerome affirmeth as much, that the 70 were interpreters. They were not prophets. They did many things well as learned men, but yet as men they stumbled and fell. One while through oversight, another while through ignorance. Yea, sometimes they may be noted to add to the original, and sometimes to take from it, which made the apostles to leave them many times when they left the Hebrew, and to deliver the sense thereof according to the truth of the word, as the Spirit gave them utterance. This may suffice touching the Greek translations of the Old Testament." All right, so we see a very similar vein that Miles Smith is conveying in the preface. We see that also with Answorth as well. Now, why this is important is that David Norton, in Volume 1 of The History of the Bible as Literature, it was done in two volumes, and then there was one that was kind of condensed. But in Volume 1, he talks about Answorth's translation circulating along with the printed text of the King James Bible. So, quote, "Some significance may attach to the fact that the King James Bible was not insisted on by the authorities as the only Bible of the land. Older versions remained in use. The Bishop's Bible New Testament continued to be printed until 1617. The annotated revisions of parts of the Old Testament, 1616 to 1623, by Henry Answorth, minister of a separatist congregation in Amsterdam, continued to be printed in London as well as Amsterdam until 1629, apparently without official hindrance." So we see that, again, this is around the time where the King James Bible is starting to be printed. It's not exactly seen, you know, like it is today, as this, you know, popular translation of the Bible that people read. We still have other things going on. There's a lot of Geneva Bibles circulating at this time, Bishop's Bible, New Testaments, and also we have Henry Answorth's translation coming in as well. So we have all of these different things going on here, and we do have work that was done in 1619. That's when Answorth did his work on Deuteronomy in particular. We see that is also circulating at this time along with everything else. So that becomes important.
So, yeah. Before you move on, a couple sort of high level comments. Okay. First, what you're showing here is again a point that I made in the From This Generation Forever class, that when the King James Bible rolled off the press in 1611, it was not just immediately received by the entirety of the English speaking world as, oh, finally we have God's word in English, right? There were other considerations, other factions within the English church that had their own sorts of, you know, proclivities. And it took a little while for the King James to assert itself. I did argue, though, and From This Generation Forever, that this happened a lot quicker than most people, you know, than a lot of people maybe realize. There's been some good scholarly work done in the last 5 to 7 years on that topic. I won't rehash all that here, just throwing that out there. The other thing is the King James translators clearly did reference the LXX, the Septuagint, in the preface. But they don't do it. They do it in a sort of very, my reading of Miles Smith, my understanding of the quote that you just gave was that they don't view it as infallible. They don't view it as, you know, above reproach. And you have to check the LXX against the Hebrew to really know where those places are that they did a good job versus where those places are that the LXX didn't do such a good job. Now, so the translators, we could get into a long thing about the LXX and when it came into existence and all that. I talk about that in other videos, but they seem to have an awareness of it, and they do reference it in the preface.
Yep. So we see here that, again, the King from Neighbors to Neighbor first occurs in an edition of the English Bible that's not the King James, albeit it's a very similar reading, though. It is a new translation done by Henry Answorth, who's considered the eminent Hebrew scholar of his time. The verse is verbally equivalent, however, editorial work was clearly done. So we move on here from 1619, and we go to other editions. And all other 1619 editions from London, there's no King to Deuteronomy 23:25 present. And from 1620 to 1626, there is no King to the verse, with the exception of a 1626 London octavo. So we see here that, in particular, when it comes to the neighbor here, right, it is singular. Now, what I will say about this is that this is the only time in 1626 with London that we see this here. And I'm going to scroll a little bit down here to another table that I did. So when I was looking at this, I went through the Dropbox and I was seeing again what exactly we had. And we see here that in 1626, this is 8403. This is a London duodecimo in Roman font. This has the neighbors plural. Okay. Then in 1627, again, anything that's pre-1629, it's most likely going to be, you know, a London printing. So these London printings right here, in 627, we have it being plural back to neighbors, and then it goes on from 1628. So most likely, I am going to show you examples where the neighbors is this editorial king, but right now in 1626, I would most likely consider this example a printer's error, because we only have just this one data point from 1626. We need to either see that, you know, at least for me when I'm doing this, I would like to see that there is more than one edition that kind of has this king, you know, throughout. If you have an edition that has this king throughout, then you most likely can make a case that it is an editorial king. Or if you have evidence like we have with Answorth and even with Scattergood that there is this king being made to the text. But
so Alex, what you're saying then is that the 1626 London octavo that you have on the screen there, you're saying that the most charitable interpretation of the evidence is that is in 1626 a one-off, meaning the printer left the S off accidentally, that is not a intentional editorial change. And the reason you're saying that is because when you look at subsequent editions from the same press, you don't see that same change occurring.
That's correct.
Okay.
That is correct. We then go on and we see from 1627 to 1629, we see that there's no really Kangas of the Verse, with the exception of a 1629 London folio with Kangas the comma after neighbors to a colon. So this comma right here, right, which is it's always been there, this has been changed now to a colon. And I would also consider this to be a printer's error, and I'm going to share this right here. Now, this is an example from Joseph Maxson's 1683 Mechanic Exercises. This is something that a lot of people will turn to because it explains some, you know, contemporary things at the time when it comes to printing, the printing press, how exactly these things were done here. And there's a lot of compartments here, but I want to zoom in right here to this particular area, because this is where we see here that we have, you know, the colon, and then we have a comma right here. Notice here how close together these are. All right, so this right here, this is where the comma is, and then this is where the colon is. So you can see just, again, how they're close together, how the compartments are small. So, again, this is the only these readings, and the reason why there's two is because most likely the same text block was used for both of these. So I would say that because they're so very close together in this diagram, in the diagram I showed you, and this would this press, the one that I showed, to be emblematic of a lot of the different printers. It's not just London, but others. I can definitely see why this would be considered, again, a printer's error, right? Just because of how close the punctuation marks are.
So, yeah, that's good that you show that in the tray, in the printing tray there. Scroll back down just a bit so you get both of those on the screen again. So just to point out for the audience that, you know, the one from 1626, the neighbor is singular, but then in the same press 3 years later, it's back to plural, and now we have a different punctuation mark. So you're to stack upon what you said earlier, there's why you're saying that you think the neighbor singular reading in 1626 at the time was a printer error and not a intentional edit, because later editions from the London press reinsert the S back into the text.
That's correct. That is correct. Now, we see more things going on here. So major and lesser editions from 1619 to the early 1650s, they exhibit no changes to the verse, but we have a 1653 London duodecimo, which changes the colon before but to a comma. So this would be a colon right here, and we also see that it's colon is here, but then we have this comma right here. Now, again, as I showed you with Maxson's exercise, with mechanic exercises, you can see just how close they are to each other. So you can see how easy it could be to make this printer error like this. And again, it's exactly like what we see. And I can even do the two pages here with everything.
You so zoom you in see, on that. There we go.
Yeah, this is as far as I can go with everything in it. So we see the neighbor singular in 1626. In 1629, we have that reading coming back, but then we have the colon, and then we have also neighbors here. Okay, so with the one exception in 1626, we see that the London press is consistently printing neighbors. We're seeing that it's consistently printing it as plural and not singular.
Yep. Yep.
So then we're going to talk about what exactly happened in the 1670s, because this is going to become important when we talk about the real work done to this verse. So the major and lesser editions from the early 1650s through the 1670s, they exhibit no changes to the verse until we get to the work of Scattergood in the 1677 and the 1683 Cambridge Quartos. So we see here, this is 1677, we see here everything else is the same except neighbor becomes singular. Okay, so neighbor, where it was plural, now becomes singular. Okay, so we have that in 1677. We then get to 1683, when thou comest into the standing corn of thy neighbor. So again, it's continuing on with the singular here. So a reading that arguably we could say began in 1619, because with Answorth's work in 1619, we do know he did provide his fresh translation. This was singular in his translation. We see here that, again, a reading going back to 1619, we see that it is in 1677. Now, Francis Parris, F.S. Parris, in his initial work of 1743, he retains the editorial work of Scattergood by keeping neighbor singular in Deuteronomy 23:25. And we see that Parris in 1762, he departs from this reading in his 1762 Cambridge Folio and makes it possessive. So this is his duodecimo of 1743. You see that it's singular. But then in 1762, we see that it's possessive. So this is the apostrophe S, all right? So he's no longer, he's not making it plural, he's just making it, you know, a possessive here.
Yeah.
We then see Blaney in his 1769 Oxford Folio. He reverts back to a reading of Deuteronomy 23:25, going back to 1619. So he's making it singular again, not plural. Blaney's work also agrees with that of Scattergood in the 1670s and the 1680s and has become the standard reading. So when thou comest into the standing corn of thy neighbor, okay, and then the rest of it. So if you have the 1769 text, say this is the standard reading, this is what you are reading today in a King James Bible. But as we've seen, there's a lot of things going on with this verse when it comes to the printer's errors, but also the editorial change done.
So before you get to the conclusion, let me just make a couple observations if I could. So
yep.
The 1611 has neighbors with an S, correct?
Exactly, yep.
The first example that we see of it being neighbor singular is with Ainsworth in 1619.
Correct.
Then there's a 1626 London that seems as a one-off to publish the verse without the S, right?
Yep.
And then from that point forward, going all the way through into the 1550s, 1660s, London is publishing the text as neighbors with an S. The first example that we can see of a clear, intentional editorial change is Scattergood in 1677 and 1683, and then Parris accepts that change into the 1743 duodecimo, but then he does something a little bit strange with the 1762 folio, where he makes it a possessive, and then Blaney sets it back to the standard reading now of neighbor. So, Alex, it's clear to me when you look at the evidence and you actually look at the printings and you evaluate things for what they actually are, that there is no doubt that this is an editorial change, and readers of the AV today in 2025 are not reading only the choices of the translators from 1611. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, I would agree, yes.
Okay, so let's see what you got for your conclusion. This is all good, Alex. Appreciate you putting this together. This is a good example of an editorial change.
Yep, thank you. So Deuteronomy 23:25 is a clear example of an editorial change, not a printer's error. Of course, we see other things going on, but with the case of neighbors and neighbor, it's an editorial change. The difference between plural and singular does not change the meaning of the verse as demonstrated by the context in the underlying Hebrew. So I have the good old blue letter Bible pulled up here. And you have to look at these verses kind of in context to see what it is here. So when thou comest into thy neighbor's vineyard, then thou mayest eat grapes. Thy fool hath thine own pleasure, but thou shalt not put any in thy vessel. So again, the context here is neighbors here. We're talking about neighbors. We're talking about, again, going into the vineyard. You know, and then it talks about the verse we've been talking about, when thou comest into the standing corn of thy neighbor, then thou mayest pluck the ears with thine hand, but thou shalt not move a sickle onto thy neighbor's standing corn. So again, if you do it neighbors plural, neighbor singular, it doesn't change the doctrinal meaning of the verse. We're still talking about the neighbors here. If we go to the tools just briefly here, and we see this is the thing we're talking about, of thy neighbor, we can go here. We see that the number here is singular. Okay, so most likely what's going on here is that they're trying to render the Hebrew here in a kind of a more accurate sense when it comes to, again, making it singular and not plural there. All right, so that's most likely why they are making this change here that we see.
Alex, before you go any further with that, can I point something out that I just noticed listening to you talk about this? So I'm gonna remove your share quick, and I'm gonna throw mine up if that's all right.
That's okay.
And I want to present. You just showed the previous verse, right?
Yep.
So here's a 16:11. Can you see this?
Yep.
So here's verse 24. Notice, and when thou cometh into thy neighbor's vineyard, and notice here, neighbors has no possessive S.
Correct. Yep.
What you just showed on Blue Letter Bible is a possessive S right here. Okay. And then you come down here, and when thou cometh into, so this was edited.
Yep.
And this was edited to make this make more sense in English, right? So this is, this is possessive. And you said this was singular from what I just heard, correct?
Yep.
So what you're pointing out here is, so there's an edit here, there's an edit here. So there's two edits at minimum. There might be more here if we were to study this more closely. Right. But it's clear. There's no doubt in my mind that what we're dealing with here is an edited situation. So I'm going to put that's not what I want. Hang on. Put your doc back up and continue.
Yeah. So, again, that's just more of an observation here that we're seeing here. Can you see the notes again?
Oh, hang on. There we go. So can you zoom in a little, please?
Yeah. So what Brian just mentioned there, again, I didn't look at verse 24, so I had no idea that verse being good. But, again, more editorial work that we're seeing done to these series of verses here. So, again, this connects with my last point here. The true story of the printed history of the King James Bible is not only told in greater editions, the folios, but in the lesser editions, or quartos, octavos, duodecimos, what have you. It is dangerous to ascribe a particular reading to a particular edition without taking this into account. And recall my statement that I made in the Scattergood video. In Appendix 8 of the Textual History of the King James Bible, Norton ascribes the change from neighbor's plural to neighbor singular, as first appearing in Blaney's 1769 edition. This is on page 205. However, the first occurrence of this change was in the 1677 and 1683 Cambridge Quartos, as far as we know at this time. Paris in a 1762 Cambridge Folio departed from the reading of Deuteronomy 23:25 in the 1677 and the 1683 Quartos, and instead edited the verse to read neighbor's apostrophe S. Blaney in 1769 was following the editorial work completed in the 1677 and 1683 Cambridge Quartos. We can amend to that, again, the reading was first introduced in 1619 with Answorth and, again, his work on the Pentateuch.
It makes me wonder, Alex, it makes me wonder if in 1762 the typesetter, their eye, accidentally ran up to the previous verse. And that's why they stuck an apostrophe in verse 25.
Could be possible.
Just a thought, but go ahead.
Yeah. So that's essentially all that I have on my end. And then this is just the appendix here with all of the additions that I looked at. Again, with all of the major things that I looked at. Again, these we've talked about as printer's errors. This is the first time that we see the change. And then the additional data and the notes that I presented last week when it came to the 1683, looking at 1677 through 1683, that shows you more and gives you more of an indication as to what exactly that they did. So
we're going to make Alex's document public again. We'll put it on the Grace Life Bible Church website, and we'll link to it in the description underneath this video when we put it on YouTube. So, Alex, we got a couple minutes here. It seems to me that this is a prime example of why one would not want to adopt verbatim identicality as the standard for preservation, because it's just not the case that the King James Bible was printed with verbatim identicality. I mean,
correct,
so yeah. from the time of Scattergood's work in 1677 and 1683, all the way through, we're just talking about the one verse here in Deuteronomy 23:25 for like 83 years or so. The text is not published with uniformity in that verse. So if you're going to demand jot and tittle, verbatim, Xeroxed, exact identicality, then which one of these is the one that got it all correct? But when you realize that what the Bible would say is that verbal equivalence is the standard for preservation, we argue that in the book, The Myth of Verbatim Identicality, Dave Reed and I make this argument. I just don't know what other conclusion that a King James advocate and believer who's concerned about weighing facts and evidence, I just don't know what other conclusion somebody would come to. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it clearly is something that is an issue, especially when you look at these editions. These verses are not being printed with uniformity, and so it's, again, very dangerous to, A, know when exactly the change has occurred, because even Norton is wrong with that. And then the other thing, too, understanding which one, you know, you go into a position of what exactly is correct, and it becomes an issue. And one of the things to point out is that we look at verses on preservation, Psalms 12, 6, and 7. You know, God promised to preserve the words, not the spelling. And that's important to understand here. He promised to preserve his words. So we see all of these changes going on here. But when we, again, we look at what exactly is happening, we see that, again, they're not changing the doctrine of the verse. They're not changing anything. It's just, okay, how the word here that is used is correct. How exactly do we make it clearer? How exactly do we further refine this more and more? That's what we see with these changes. We're not seeing things being taken out. We're not seeing whole entire doctrines changed like we see with the modern versions that are based on a different text. We're seeing the issue of a further refinement, and it's not necessarily like easy words that are being added here. It's, you know, again, looking at the originals and saying, okay, how do we necessarily explain this?
So in my mind, there's a difference between a different way of saying the same thing and a substantive difference in meaning.
Correct.
The modern versions, the modern critical text and modern versions substantively alter the doctrinal substance of the scriptures by what they are leaving out, by what they are changing. What we're talking about here with respect to the printed history of the King James text is not the same thing that we see when we will compare the King James against a modern version. It's just, it's not the same thing because they're not in the same category of change.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
So Alex, why, just let's just sort of end with this question. Why do you think that many King James Bible believers and advocates have had such a problem with the view staked out in the book, The Myth of Verbatim Identicality?
I would say the main problem is that most of them have been raised in certain environments and churches, particularly among, like, you know, the IFB crowd and things like this, where they've been taught the same type of stuff. There's no changes in the words. It's just spelling, the punctuation, the printer's errors. Like, again, those things do happen, but it's not the thing where, you know, obviously it's not the only thing. We do see these editorial changes made. I also think that there is some speculation because they haven't actually seen these editions themselves. If you were to actually see these editions, like I have, and first of all, you have to come at it with the right mindset, you know. I do have a bias when it comes to the Word of God. I believe that God inspired every word and he preserved every
Amen.
Word. Now, based on
yeah.
that, I look and I see, okay, what is this change? And whenever I look at a variant, I want to read the chapter. I want to see, okay, why exactly are they making these things? And when you look at it, really look at it and study it, you will find they are not changing doctrines again. They are not completely obliterating the meaning of the verse again. They're looking and they're saying, how do we explain this? But when you just explain it like that and you don't exactly do this work with all the additions, a lot of people will kind of sound the alarms, or they'll kind of think to themselves, okay, he's trying to correct the king.
Yeah. You still with me?
I'm sorry?
You still, all right, you froze up there for a second. I was just checking to see if you're still with me.
Yeah. But again, we see that people who are not looking at these additions, most likely they would say, well, things are going on. But in reality, it's not. So it's the circumstances. Yeah, go on. Yeah.
Let me share with you another thought I'm having on this, and you could tell me what you think of it. So I think particularly of David Reagan's piece, The Myth of Early Revision. I think it was written in the late 80s, okay?
Yeah.
We talked in the last video about how he was Scrivener reliant, and what we meant by that was he didn't actually look at any of these editions himself.
Yeah.
Okay? So now, Alex, through the databases, through technology, we now have the ability to take Herbert's catalog, and we have the ability to actually locate the actual editions and look at them with our own eyeballs, correct? I know you would agree with that.
Absolutely,
so
yes.
My thought that I'm having is this. I can understand 30, 40 years ago, before the advent of modern databases and ability to see these things for oneself, where some of the argumentation could have passed off as sufficient. But
yeah.
The problem now is we're totally seeing past all that now, and we're now able to get to the bottom of the matter by looking at the actual editions ourselves.
Correct.
What I have a problem with is I can exercise charity towards people in the past who didn't have the access that we now have. I understand that. I can exercise charity towards that. What I don't understand, though, is people in our day who can see the evidence that is being presented and are still doubling down on old explanations that are clearly not factually accurate. What do you think about that statement?
Yeah, again, a lot of the things that I've kind of said, we do have a lot of information that is out there. And again, you don't necessarily have to look at databases myself. A lot of the things that are in early English books online, there are also in archive.org, which is a public database. So,
and Google Books.
And Google Books. So this information is out there. Now you have to know kind of how to look for it. It's not
right.
It's not just going to be on a platter for you served. You have to know how to find it. But again, you really need to look at it objectively, and you have to say that they are making these changes to the verse. Because when a reading is like the way that it is in 1611, and by the time we get to the 1769, it's different. You have to ask yourself, what happened here? It's not just, you know, a printer's error all the time. So I would say that it is kind of, you know, a little bit frustrating to see, you know, that, you know, we're presenting kind of this evidence, and it is real type of evidence here, and the people are not accepting it, and they're really relying on their tradition. They're not changing the tradition to kind of conform with the facts on the ground that we see.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that in a position, you need to alter your position to cohere with the evidence that exists.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, there's a lot of doubling down on faith for faith's sake, or, oh, it's just a faith position. I don't have to pay attention to any of this stuff because David Reagan said so in 1986. And that just doesn't work. It's not going to age well as more and more things become known about this to adopt that position. And I would agree with, and I think you would agree with this, Alex, like I am where I am on the Bible issue because I believe that the Bible teaches its own inspiration, and because I believe the Bible teaches its own preservation. Then when you encounter the reality of variant readings, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater or chuck the doctrine of preservation. What you do is you say, okay, The Bible taught me to believe in preservation. Let me look back to the scriptures now to inform my understanding of how I should view now the secondary issue of how did that preservation occur.
Yeah.
So, Alex, again, I appreciate your time in preparing the document and your willingness to join me here for this conversation. Look forward to talking about and discussing more things in the future. Did you have any final thoughts you wanted to share before I give the gospel and conclude the video?
No, I have nothing else to share.
All right. Well, if you're watching this video and you're like, boy, these guys can yammer on a long time about Bible translation and variants and this and that. Yeah, that's true. But the most important thing is what that Bible teaches about Jesus Christ and who Christ is and what Christ has done for us. And the reality is that God loves you and that Christ died for your sin. And God sent his son, the Lord Jesus Christ. He came to this earth. He suffered. He shed his blood there on the cross to satisfy the offended justice of God against sin so that God could offer us eternal life as a free gift through the work of his son. He rose again the third day, the victor over sin and death. And God is offering us today eternal salvation as a free gift by simply trusting in the finished work of his son, the Lord Jesus Christ. Stop relying in your works, your church going, your performance, whatever you think you're doing to make yourself right before God, and trust and rely exclusively on Jesus Christ, his death for your sin, his resurrection from the dead. Trust Christ today before it's everlasting too late. Thanks for your attention, and we'll see you next time.